Spain entered the World Cup this year as the defending champs and also as reigning European champs. So it was really surprising that they lost their first game 5-1 to the Netherlands. And in that game, their goalkeeper Iker Casillas made one huge mistake that caused the goal and several more mistakes that might have let some in. And the surprise then turned to shock in their second game when Spain lost to Chile 2-0 and Casillas made more mistakes. After just two games, they were eliminated in the first great shock of this year's World Cup. And Casillas became one of the most reliable of sports cliches. He became the scapegoat. Then Italy needed a scapegoat after their own early exit. Is it the coach? Is it the striker who didn't produce? The goalie who let in a couple questionable shots? Emotions run high and people need someone to blame. There has to be someone you can blame. I remember 2 years ago when we were here in the summertime, the name Tim Lincecum was being thrown out with a lot of anxiety associated with his name, if you remember the struggles he had that summer. And I tell you that story first so that when I tell you the next one, hopefully, it's not going to sound as just so old and weird and primitive that you would never think it has any relevance to us. Listen carefully to this one. The ancient Assyrians had a tradition that they could call upon in times of disaster when it threatened. And the Old Testament scholar John Walton calls this the substitute king ritual. So say something really horrible, an omen happened like an eclipse. Such a horrible sign suggested the life of the king himself was in danger. The gods must be angry. There is a great gap separating our cultures, yet these were real people dealing with a real crisis. And so this is what they would do. The magicians would use sign telling to select a substitute king and queen. They would invest this king with all the symbols of office for 100 days while the real king went into hiding. This substitute king would do special ceremonies that would call the power of this omen down onto himself. And then at the end of 100 days, the king and queen would be put to death, and the real king could resume his office. It's not that the Assyrians believed their gods were so stupid they could be tricked, but they wanted to be able to give them a ready victim. They could not know why their gods were mad at them, but they could give them an easy target for their anger and hope to somehow escape. We don't want to admit that we live so much of our own days in vague fear, anxiously trying to find some explanation or some victim to blame. The Assyrians were not some sort of obscure tribe. They were the elite culture of their day, and that was the solution that made the most sense to them. What separates us from them is less than we would like to believe. Anxious scapegoating goes on all the time, in business and politics and even families. And when something threatens the whole, there's no more common move than to identify one person that we can put all the blame onto so the rest of us can move on. All we've lost is the blatant religious expression, maybe the outright murder, but the forces that are still so much the same. And I think that example from Assyria then helps us to understand a little bit better why it was that the Ten Commandments fell like a meteor out of the sky. Instead of people wondering what in the world the gods are out there and what they want, Yahweh acts first. He saves his people. Instead of some kind of swirl of gods, there's only one God who's the true creator. Instead of malicious gods who never disclose their minds, Yahweh says exactly what he wants. Instead of demanding care from the people, Yahweh gives moral commandments. Instead of throwing victims into the machinery to be destroyed, each person knows and is responsible individually before God for his own choices. So I really appreciated Steve's introductory sermon last week, and it's important for us to frame the law carefully as New Testament believers. But as Steve pointed out, we don't throw it out. It is still very precious to us. We're here this morning to examine and receive courage from the genius of the first commandment. And I think it sharpens our focus. It helps us if we go back and forth between the world as it was and the world we live in today, because the world we live in today looks more and more like the old pagan one. The first commandment simply states in Exodus 23, "You shall have no other gods before me." This is extremely personal language. He has already told us his name, Yahweh. He is the Lord, your God, single person. You and you and you. In this verse, he demands that you have no other gods before him. Hebrew is a very earthy language, and literally it says something like, "There will be no other gods for you on my face." God demands intimate, direct, exclusive relationship with each one of us. And it's hard to appreciate how enormous this was. After millennia of monotheism, and that we have accustomed ourselves to the idea, if we're going to bother to pray at all, we'll pray to the Creator God of the universe. But the first commandment required the ancient Israelites to leap through several levels of their own cosmic conception of the universe. In the ancient Near East, the first cause of the universe, whatever it was, hides behind even the greatest gods of the pantheon. The great gods were not themselves creators. They had maybe shaped or worked on the existing creation. These gods were often then national gods, the god whose worship unified a certain people. But even the national gods were not really the concern of normal folk. It was the job of the king and a priesthood to take care of the national god. And in most of these cultures, then every day, the national god would be woken, washed, clothed, fed, and put back to bed at the end of the day by the national priesthood. Common people didn't need to bother themselves with that. Religion for normal people was found primarily in prayer to more local household gods and ancestors. These smaller gods were more likely to notice and care about the needs of average people. Needs that, again, John Walton called a sound reputation, social success, material prosperity, and of course, the ability to have children. Does that sound familiar? Has that much really changed? I'll read this again. A sound reputation, social success, material prosperity, and of course, the ability to have children. It was these small gods who were likely to be able to grant the favors that could lead to a life in abundance. Yet the small gods, just like the great gods, are really hard to read. It was easy to inadvertently offend them and draw their wrath. Religion was like trying to walk in the dark without a flashlight, hoping you don't end up stumbling in the dark. You feared these gods, you bowed down before them, but you didn't really love them. They were, however, within reach. You had a shot with them of getting what you needed. They weren't good, but you could hope they would be good to you. But the first commandment just collapses all of these levels together. The remote creative force of the universe, the national god, and the family god were really all one. Yahweh. The radical thing is the identification of such an intimate God with the otherwise completely remote and inaccessible creator, and that he is actually the provider of everyone's daily needs. And this helps explain why the Israelites really did have such a hard time throughout their history in the Old Testament, grasping that there was no space for them to worship local gods. They had a really hard time just even thinking in these categories, that they couldn't worship Yahweh on the national level and then still have their own local gods. And so this is what I want to focus on this morning, the small gods that we put on God's face. Centuries of Christian history and the Enlightenment helped us in places like America to just largely forget about demons, spirits, ghosts, superstitions, rules of purity, evil eye, magic, curses, and a whole lot of other small gods by which people seek to live in abundance and avoid calamity. Yet they never really went away in the rest of the world, and to a great extent, the same forces exist in our society under different names. The English public thinker Ferdinand Mount, who is a former editor of the famous Times Literary Supplement, wrote a book on this a few years ago, and it's called Full Circle, How the Classical World Came Back to Us. He analyzed our attitudes towards things today like the body, food, sex, religion, and fame. And what he showed is that throwing off our Christian heritage did not bring us into a brand new world where we think totally new thoughts. It just threw us right straight back into the old pagan one. He observes that so much about our society that is now emerging bears an astonishing resemblance to the most prominent features of what we call the classical world. We may call our small gods differently, but the impulses and the results are so similar. We give partial loyalty to things that seem to help us. We search for a better deal. We feel unending anxiety, and we try to manage the unmanageable. Small gods thrive on our desire for social acceptance and our fear of exclusion. This is their realm. They tell us things like, I can take the pain away. I can make people like you. I can fix that. I can get you what he has. They do not claim to be asking for our full loyalty. They seem to just be offering an exchange. They say, I will do that for you if you do something for me. Yahweh, in contrast, makes all of his demands up front and completely. Small gods make it all seem so easy and manageable and favorable, but they never stop asking for more. There's a lot of fine print, it turns out, we did fail to read. It's like being in the line at Disneyland. You get around the corner, you think you're about to get on the ride, and there's just another room full of people waiting in front of you. It turns out that our brand loyalties look an awful lot like the loyalties people felt to their small gods in the ancient world. This is an observation that comes not from a Christian critic, but from a marketing expert named Marty Neumeier, who states that brands are the little gods of modern life, each ruling a different need, activity, mood, or situation, yet you're in control. Like fads or brands, small gods represent a life we aspire to and disasters we hope to avoid. And as long as it works for us, we're going to go along for the ride, and we're going to make our offerings, we're going to purchase, and receive a product in return. And the product in return somehow always gives us what we ordered, and yet leaves us not quite full. With the small gods, the packaging is always better than the product. And they entice us through envy, and they sell us on this glossy catalog vision of life. There's this great rant on the internet about what the Williams-Sonoma catalog does to its readers. It's this amazingly perceptive piece of parody that I've managed to edit to be church appropriate and just read you this one quote. The Williams-Sonoma universe is a magical, pristine, alternate dimension where every room has crown molding and your wife can squeeze out a perfect red velvet bundt cake in 9 seconds flat from her Wolf oven and you are stinking rich. But there's really nothing to it. It's a hollow life. There can be all sorts of small gods. I think anything we consume in exchange for a feeling or a certain result can be one. I think for me, a small god a number of years ago was listening to the radio talk show host and right-wing guy, Michael Savage. When we first got married, we were often commuting in the car in the evening together when he was on. And at first, listening to him was fun. He was shocking and amusing. And yet over time, I found myself taking him more and more seriously. I started to pay my dues, to give him my, you know, a time and attention. In return, I got this really powerful narrative of what's going on in America. The funny thing about this small god for me is that it disappeared from my life, not because I got convicted about it, but just because we left. God called us to go to Croatia as missionaries, and then we were gone. And I never thought about him for a really long time until a couple years later I was in the car and I was listening and he came on and I thought, oh my gosh, I used to take this guy seriously. As good Westerners, we can hardly believe, bring ourselves to entertain the idea that our small gods ever can get any hold on us. We think we are in control and can walk away. We have a hard time taking seriously that there is any spiritual force at work in contemporary fads or that they could pose any danger to us. And now I think I'm kind of in danger as a preacher because this is the part where you're wondering whether I'm going to bash Harry Potter. So I think it's worth unpacking this whole thing a little bit. So let's take this example of magic, right? I've read the Harry Potter books and I like them. So there are, seem to be at least, these neutered small gods and pagan ideas that we can find quite entertaining. But is there really a danger there? There'd be some Christians who would say that if anything comes from the fruit of a poison tree, it's going to be poison, and others seem to quite enjoy it. What I've found is that the history and experience of missions actually sheds a lot of really good light on this. One of the great genius impulses of Christianity is that we believe in translating the Bible. If you're going to translate the Bible, you end up having to study local cultures because you have to pick words for very big topics. God or Gott meant something to Germanic tribes a long, long time ago before it meant anything that had to do with Christianity. Theos in Greek in the New Testament was a pagan word a long time before the Bible ended up getting written in classical Greek. You end up having to study and understand a culture and its products in order to translate the Bible. Laman Sanach, a Yale professor who's from Gambia himself, he grew up in Africa, he argues that despite usually the biases that missionaries had, they ended up almost always giving a boost to the preservation of local cultures. And traditions because they wrote them down and studied them as a part of producing Bible translations. And oftentimes what happens is the first generation of believers in a place knows how spiritual forces are tied into dance or music or ritual in their culture. And they feel the need to step away from those things. And they don't want to have anything to do with some of these cultural markers. But then later generations because they've grown up inside the church, manage to find that it's been stripped of all of its spiritual power, and that they're able to enjoy some of the cultural forms that maybe for their parents or their grandparents it seemed way too connected with the spiritual world. Several missionaries with Operation Mobilization that I met in India through a PBC trip there a number of years ago told me stories that were like this, about how they were kind of reclaiming some things that others had felt were too pagan. So it's a little bit like Christmas trees. I know a lot of us are willing to dropkick the Easter bunny, but how many of us are really so hardcore that we throw out Christmas trees, even though they have an ancient pagan connection? It turns out that the gospel makes it safe for us to enjoy things like mythology, music, dance, and a whole host of other cultural forms. A Slovenian philosopher who's this kind of gadfly in Europe named Slavoj Žižek said that only a Christian like Tolkien could write perfect pagan mythology the way he did. So on the one hand, I'm not arguing for seeing a demon under every bush and throwing out everything in the world that's connected to paganism by even the thinnest of threads. But on the other hand, I'm arguing that small gods are nasty, real, and powerful. And as the Christian framework of the West collapses, small gods are more noisy and demanding and insidious. They don't need to get a hold of us through the Easter bunny or Christmas trees. They're doing just fine through advertising and the obsessions of our contemporary lives. I propose you can get best at small gods and trying to discern them in your heart by looking at the fruit of what they bring in people's lives. If you know the fruit that they bring, you can work backwards to see them. Small gods suffocate our interior lives, the quiet, still places in our hearts. It turns out the ability to be reflective is quite a fragile thing. Our culture threw off the commandments of God, thinking that it would free us to fully explore ourselves. But a robust interior life can only be supported by walls, and walls come from commandments. Otherwise, you're just left with this churning swirl of your own social and public life. Social media is really pushing back and making us lose track of our inner lives. Instead of just experiencing what we go through and thinking about it, we start thinking about how we're going to package it to put it on the internet. That's life in a world of small gods. You're no longer a person who has walls around your heart. You're just tossed back and forth on a long journey of trying to get and then keep the regard of others, their likes, their repostings, and that kind of stuff. And when we push out everything in some sort of social media stream, we end up constructing an identity for ourselves that we have to turn around and worship. And I think similarly, we hardly believe anything anymore because of conviction, because we've thought about it in the still quiet spaces of our heart, and we've decided that that's what we think is right. We choose our political opinions on the basis of whether those beliefs align us with the kind of people that we want to be known to be aligned with. Small gods present themselves as a wise spreading of our bets. When one falters, another will pick you up. During the World Cup, I saw this repeatedly, how they would zoom in on some dejected fan of the country that was about to be eliminated from the tournament, and they had just such pathos on their face. Then only to realize they were now on television on the Jumbotron, and all of a sudden their faces would light up and they would cheer and be all excited. Because the small god of momentary fame can rescue you from the small failed god of your soccer team. But the end result of trying to cover life with one small god on another leaves us worse off, because none of them are reliable. None of them will come to you when you're down to pick you up, when you have nothing to offer. Some small gods consume the joy from our lives through making us obsessed over the smallest purity and ritual, promising that if we just get it all perfect, we'll finally feel perfect. We feel less explicit superstitious anxiety than ancient people did, but certainly a great deal of anxiety can be seen in the way we now relate to food and our environment and the things that go into our bodies. So many people, I think, lose track of the life they really have in obsessing over getting the little details right. Small gods make you, the further you go with a small god, the more you get tight, suspicious, and arrogant towards others, the more you despise those who are newbies instead of being welcoming to them. And last, small gods promise some vision of abundance and yet leave us ground down and burned out, always blaming us, you just haven't gotten the formula right yet. I think the clothing company Lululemon is just such a fantastic barometer of the day we live in. Their marketing is impeccable, and it's all about small gods, and they're quite clear about it. The founder described their vision in a blog post as all about personal greatness. Greatness is demanding the best of everything and doing what is required to get it. Greatness is demanding friends who demand the best, demanding the best wife or husband and the best job with the best pay. Whew. Small gods take an end result like greatness that should be the side product of some other pursuit, and they set it up as an end in itself. And they get things so out of order that it consumes us, and they wear us down till we could be such hollow and shallow people that we would dare say greatness is demanding the best wife or husband. Who wants to be married to a person whose affection for you is predicated on you being the best? What place does that leave for children with special needs or older people who require care or just normal, messed up people? The author of that rant about Williams-Sonoma ends his little article with a fantastic observation. In 21st century America, you are constantly being shown how much better life can be, and that is what makes your life so horribly intolerable. The first commandment cuts through all of this, denying small gods both their reality and their ability to provide for our souls. But I know it's hard to come back and step away from this. We hear, have it your way 100 times a day. Everything about this commandment is offensive to contemporary ears. It's particular, it's exclusive, it's a blanket prohibition, and it's a command not to check out your options. The first commandment lacks all contemporary cachet. It's not nuanced, it's not tolerant, and it does not embrace ambiguity. Yet everything really beautiful and lasting and true limits and embraces limits and focus and the clarity that comes from loyal commitments. We're not going to keep the beauty of weddings for long when we stop believing that the vows people are saying actually means anything. Weddings are beautiful because of the startling fact that you are watching a man and a woman revoke all their other options. Today we think that just the form of the thing and going through the motions is going to give us the same thrill as actually committing ourselves to anything. We love to watch, we play video games, we do simulations, we're pleased by just the diversionary experience of walking through the motions. Having no other gods means getting in the game ourselves and finding out how God will meet us there. And so we come back to Yahweh. He demands no care and feeding. Instead of sacrifices to small gods and then doing whatever the heck you want in your personal life, we are called to worship God by obedience in our personal lives. Inside of the commandments then, fragile, beautiful, complex, and heroic things can take place. The commandments are like a wall of a garden. They keep out the weeds and the pests so that complex things have a chance to grow inside. The commandments do not deny us life, but they create the conditions under which true life can happen. G.K. Chesterton commented that the outer ring of Christianity is a rigid guard, but inside, you will find the old human life dancing like children and drinking wine like men. For Christianity is the only possible frame for pagan freedom. But in the modern philosophy, the case is opposite. It is the outer ring that is obviously artistic and emancipated. Its despair is within. I'm reminded how much small gods have hollowed us out when I hear this song called Rehab come on the radio. It's still played a lot in Zagreb, at least. Its author, Amy Winehouse, was an incredibly talented musician who led a very troubled life. At one point, her record label really thought, we need to dump her so that she'll go and get some help, but she was just too popular and they couldn't bring themselves to pull the trigger. Rehab is a song about refusing to get treatment. 4 years after writing it, she died of alcohol poisoning after binge drinking at home. Her fans, of course, expressed their shock and their grief, and tributes poured out for her. Yet we keep on listening to this song. Even when our small gods kill us, we won't let them go. Just last week, another young musician, Lana Del Rey, was interviewed in a British paper about her most recent album, which has very dark themes, and she said, "I wish I was already dead like Amy Winehouse or Kurt Cobain." When Kurt Cobain's daughter tweeted in response how hard it was for her to grow up without her father and begged her not to say things like that, others attacked her for daring to criticize. Small gods need sacrifices. They need them to keep going. Those who gather around them always end up forming unstable communities because they're predicated upon having to sacrifice a victim every once in a while. If you read Jeremiah, the beginning of it, especially chapters 2 through 7, you'll see how little has changed. This is a long passage. It's gripping. It's psychologically immediate. Description of the people of Judah rejecting every rebuke of their addiction to their small gods. They're following after small gods and losing their conscience. Then they exploit the poor to make sure that their pleasures can continue. They ignore God's judgment on Israel and insist the same will never, ever happen to them. They are consumed by their lusts and refuse God's mercy. They become childishly unable to face reality. And in the end, there's this horrible shock in chapter 7. The people desperately commit the ultimate atrocity, sacrificing their own children in the fire to a pagan god, without any idea why they even did it anymore. So how much has really changed? We think ourselves shrewd and nuanced. Restrictions are obsolete. I can handle it. I used a spreadsheet to calculate how far I can go, and I'm not going to go any further. I can grab what I want from my small gods. I won't mess up like those other guys who got addicted. They just did it wrong. I know better. I'll get what I want. I'll fill myself with good things. I won't go over the cliff. If I don't try, I'll never get the best. And then somehow we are shocked, when our small gods destroy yet another person and leave those around them helpless. Our small gods then give us a day or two to cool our jets, and then they come back and they say, hey, that was just a glitch. You'll be fine. They were a loser, dead weight. Don't worry about it. And sometimes they even whisper to you and they'll say, you know, we do need a sacrifice every once in a while. But there is another way. The Lord Yahweh, the Savior God, still holds real life out to us. He says, you cannot get there that way. I leave no space for small gods. I will give you more than you can ever imagine, directly, personally, my own life, but I won't do it as just another one of your gods. If we are willing to put those gods away, he is still waiting. In the midst of that horrible passage in Jeremiah, God calls out in kindness. In verse 3:19, God says, how gladly I would treat you like my children and give you a pleasant land, the most beautiful inheritance of any nation. In the garden, there is complex, beautiful, tender life, and even in a broken world, it can be entered. I can't tell you what life will look like for you there exactly. We don't get to know ahead of time what it will grow for us there, but it will be beautiful, and it will be fitting. Philip Yancey wrote a wonderful reflection on G.K. Chesterton, who I've mentioned in a book called Soul Survivor. And as we move towards closing and trying to figure out how do we live this in front of the world, I think it's really helpful. Chesterton was a journalist in London. He was most active in the first half of the 20th century. He was a really fat man who lived in his own funky little world, and he was kind of eccentric. He was also one of the greatest Christian writers and apologists of the modern age. He would joke and fumble and talk in a funny tone of voice while defending the most traditional of Christian doctrines. He was friends with and publicly debated unbelieving intellectuals like H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw. What was striking in their debates was that on the one hand, you had this jolly fat man defending really old ideas like original sin and the Last Judgment, debating with really thin, stern, worried men who were constantly talking about how optimistic they were for the future of the world. And I think we can still play that role today in a similar way. Let us go out into this world cheerily, defending the indefensible idea that undivided loyalty to God is best, and let the thin, cold, hard prophets of the world say how wrong we are and how much we are in the way of progress. Their small gods will never satisfy. Instead, we trust Yahweh, the God we cannot control and whose favors we cannot buy. We do not know what he will give us, but it will be good, and it will be enough, and we will find rest for our souls. He will make something beautiful out of our lives if we have no other gods before his face. Let us have the attitude that Chesterton recorded once in a really short poem. He said, here dies another day, during which I have had eyes, ears, hands, and the great world round me, and with tomorrow begins another. Why am I allowed to? If we are grateful, single-minded people, those around us will have to take notice. Thank you.